From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour is made when two teenage girls go to visit a friend. They're 16, and they're meeting up with a boy they knew from summer camp. His dad makes films, and we'll learn more about that later, but right now the goal is for one of the girls, Nancy, to seduce that man's son, Judah. Nancy's friend Melly is in tow, and even though they're best friends, they're not much alike. Nancy makes it a point to know boys, she smokes weed, and she doesn't really care about school. Melly has straight A's, charts the moon from her porch, and describes herself sometimes as a baby. But she joins Nancy anyway as she goes to meet Judah, and they go to a crack house. This moment will lead to another where Melly loses her innocence and begins a two-decade addiction to a fictional memory drug called Cloud. Fast forward those two decades, and Melly is 29 days sober. It's not the first time she's tried to get clean, but this time she has her baby daughter to think about. When a black SUV screams into her driveway, her past and her path to her addiction take center stage again, and they threaten her future, her life, and the life of her daughter. It's a grippy, trippy, heartfelt story about reality, alternate realities, about addiction, about family, and about feeling. It's called The Likely World, and it's the debut novel of local writer Melanie Conroy Goldman. The Likely World will be released on Tuesday, but it's already garnered much praise. Writer Mary Gateskill has called it, quote, bizarre and beautiful, equal parts brainy lit, and gut bucket pulp. Its heroine is unlike any female character I've ever encountered, and I love her, end quote. As regular listeners know, in years past, we've done what we called Summer Books Week on this show. Well, the summer is a little different this year, and we're doing things a little differently on the talk show due to the pandemic, but we still want to bring you conversations about literature. So today we dive into The Likely World with Melanie Conroy Goldman. She's joining us from her home in Ithaca today, or maybe her writer's shed, I'll have to ask her. But Melanie, congratulations on the book, and welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here, Megan.
And I do want to ask you about that shed, but first, I know you have some events coming up to celebrate your book, which look a little different because of events being shut down, but you found a way to work around it. So before we talk about the story itself, I know you have something coming up on Tuesday when the book is released. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. The traditional book tour is just impossible during the pandemic. And I figured that all events will be virtual. But then I had a friend who suggested that we do the launch at a drive-in. And drive-ins were one of the first places that Cuomo allowed to open up in New York State. So we're going to be having a book launch and movie viewing on August 4th at the Finger Lakes Drive-In. So it'll be live and socially distanced. And then that'll be followed up with a series of virtual events.
That's great. And I know one of those virtual events is next Thursday, August 6th at 7 o'clock, and that's a Writers and Books event. It's a virtual visiting author series event, and you'll be chatting with Writers and Books director Allison Myers. I know that's free. You can sign up at writersandbooks.org. And I know you're teaching a class, too, and that's August 15th. I'd like to talk about that a little later in the hour because the title of it, The Circle in the Line, is something that I think relates directly to The Likely World. So we have a lot to talk about this hour, and I know that we might have many listeners interested in your book. Where can they find it on Tuesday?
So it's available anywhere books are sold, but especially at the bookshop at Writers and Books, which is called Ampersand Books, and you can also connect to them online.
Great. So let's talk about the story itself, Melanie, and I want to be careful because I don't want to give away any spoilers. There could be many, so I'm going to need your help as we go throughout the hour so I don't reveal too much. But let's start with the main character, Melly. When we first meet her, she's 16. As I mentioned, she's highly motivated to be successful. She wants to work in politics, but the crowd that she runs with doesn't quite match those ambitions. What do you want listeners to know about Melly?
Well, I guess the thing is that she sees herself as a nerd, and she's a good student, and she's driven, and she's looking ahead to her future, but none of that stops her from being subject to the usual teenage anxieties. She wants to fit in, she wants to grow up, and she has this friend, Nancy, who's very dear to her, and she apprentices herself to Nancy. And I think Nancy is a character that a lot of people can connect with. She's not a student, but she is very good at things like automobiles, and she's really interested in the inside of her carburetor. She's also brave, and I think that's what Melly admires about her. But in following her friend, she ends up in some pretty dark places.
You mentioned that, and I was watching a reading event that you were part of, and you said there's always a bit of darkness in a true friendship. When we first meet these girls, we hear about them watching soap operas together and talking about boys and clothes, but this world that Nancy is part of ultimately brings Melly into it, and it has some pretty dark consequences. What should we know early on about that world?
Well, one of the things that fascinates me about adolescence, and I have three adolescents of my own, and of course I was there, I was an adolescent girl too, is that that young people can really feel and seem like adults a lot of the time. And they're facing some of the most critical decisions anyone will ever face, decisions about their bodies and about consent and decisions about substances. So they're exposed to these very high-stakes decisions, but their frontal lobes aren't developed, and they're not decision-makers like adults are. And so I think that kids, with their love of danger, end up in some pretty scary places sometimes.
And Melly finds a scary place with Judah and this drug that she ultimately becomes addicted to. Cloud, I just want our listeners to know, a fictional drug that Melanie created, and it's hard for me to express how believable this is. I read the entire book, and I felt like I was the character, Melly, and I was trying to make connections and places that I couldn't remember as this character, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. But Cloud is a memory-altering drug, and Melanie, what should we know about Cloud in the sense of how it can affect a person over time?
So I think of it as a drug that's a cure for regret. And I think anyone can connect with this. We all just say something or do something that seconds later we think, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Mm. And we've all had those moments where we think, if I could just take that moment out of my brain, if I could just excise that part of my thought process, I'd be okay. And Cloud is the answer for that. So it's incredibly tempting. You take it and it erases your short-term memory, so whatever mistake you've made vanishes. But of course, the problem is that those mistakes don't really vanish. And so Melly, as she becomes addicted to this drug, begins to feel like there's the life of the person who remembered all the things she's forced herself to forget that still exists right next to her. But she can't see it and she can't access it. So this ends up giving her a really disconnected sense of herself. And over time, the drug has long-term consequences so that users end up feeling like they're less people than they would have been, that they're less fully human. And I think that's because our memories really are, even our painful ones, what make us who we become. And so this temptation of getting rid of loss, getting rid of pain that we all feel is also something that we can't do if we want to be fully human.
I think a really, I don't know if the word sad is the right one here or tragic, but a really sad part of the story is when Melly first takes her first hit of Cloud, and she's having a really hard time fitting in with her friends. She feels like she's a baby and she wants to forget. If you want to talk about the incident in which this happens, we can. I'm looking for your guidance regarding how much to give away and how much not to. But I think there's a message in there for parents, for teachers, for teenagers. I mean, was that part of the focus behind the book, or was that just an impact that has come across?
Melly has this very simple feeling. She likes a boy. There's nothing wrong with that feeling, but there's also no one to guide her. He doesn't like her back. And so it's very simple, very universal, the kind of thing that I think probably almost every teenager goes through. She can't handle this moment of rejection. And that's why she turns to Cloud. It's available. She has easy access to it, and she's having this intense set of emotions without any guidance, and so she seeks forgetting. And that launches her on really a career of addiction.
Mm-hmm. What was? And go ahead. Sorry, Melanie. Go ahead.
I think the thing that that we don't do as grown-ups in this world is to tell our kids what desire feels like. Of course we don't. I mean, I'm a mom. I don't want to have that conversation with my kids. It's awkward and embarrassing, and we also kind of just don't want them to feel desire. So that means that when they have these feelings, for the most part, no one's ever said to them, you can feel this, and it will be very powerful, but you can still make a choice about what to do about that feeling. And I don't know why we can't have that conversation or can't successfully communicate it, but I think it does leave our kids vulnerable.
We talked about that briefly yesterday on the program. We had a conversation about dating and relationships during the pandemic and why it's so difficult for many Americans to talk about sex. It's just part of the culture. We had a listener who called in and said he was in Europe recently and had been many times before, and it's just part of life there, and they acknowledge it openly. But here it's so different. And when it comes to having those conversations with teenagers, especially, or younger than that, it's sort of taboo in some cases. I know you're not writing a how to talk to kids about sex book, but what do you hope that people take away from some of the impacts that have come from Melly's experience?
Well, I think that as a culture, we've started to do a really good job about talking about consent, and that's great. I'm glad we're making progress in that area, and certainly my characters could have benefited from conversations about that. But what I write about is more gray areas, where it's not really about consent or lack of consent per se, but it's about these things that people can slip into. Teenagers with their lack of experience and, frankly, their raging hormones just don't know how to navigate those sensations. And I think we do need to talk to kids about pleasure, about your body can feel really good or really attracted to someone, that can be a powerful feeling, and you need ways to navigate that, to say to yourself, is this the right person for me? Is this something I want to be doing right now? And there's a kind of adultlessness to the world of the novel. The grown-ups aren't there. They're not present, and they're not able to help the kids navigate this. And I guess the thing that I wish people could take away is, let's attend to our kids. Let's be realistic about what they feel. Let's give them language to talk about it. If not to us, then to their wise friends and older mentors who are trustworthy.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, what was the impetus for the story? Is this something that you developed over many, many years? What inspired you to write this? It's so beautifully done. And when we talk more about Cloud and how it affects the way the story is told, I think, at least for me, I was so impressed by how I was taken on this journey. It's nearly impossible for me to express it well, so I apologize. But this is really, no. It's like a thriller and a heartfelt book, and it's gritty and it's raw and it's trippy at the same time. How did this all come to be?
Well, I know when I wrote the first lines because I was physically in a car and I was driving, which I do not recommend, and I apologize to anyone who might have been on Route 89 that day. But I just started to hear Melly's voice, and some of the lines I thought of that day are still in that first chapter. I reached for the nearest piece of paper that I had. I did not pull over. I'm sorry. Again, drivers on Route 89. And I just started writing the words on a piece of construction paper that on the reverse was one of my daughter's drawings. And also, I'm sorry to my daughter that I deployed her drawing in that way. And I just started writing about this this mother who was recently sober and has a baby downstairs and is just trying to stay clean. And in the early days of sobriety, that is just so hard. It's just eventually, I think most recovering addicts get to a place where they reach an equilibrium, where they don't want to drink. They don't want They don't want to hit. But in the early days, it's just every hour, every minute, every second. So I was trying to write about that feeling and what it's like to have a kid when you're trying to do that. Someone who's going to cry at any moment, need food, have just these ordinary needs. So that's where I began, for sure.
How much of yourself or people in your life have you put into the book? Or how do you see them in yourselves or yourselves in the characters? I know there's some friends or family in your life who have experienced the recovery process, and that has informed some of what you've written about. But how much of this is part of you?
Well, you know, the book is also started as a kind of experiment. There's this writer named David Shields who wrote a book published in, I think, 2011 called Reality Hunger. And in it, he basically argues that nonfiction is the future of writing. And he calls it reality-based art. And I thought, well, fiction is reality-based art, too. But there's also a part of it that's really against reality. You know, there are flying horses and magic potions. And I thought, is that stuff over? Are we done with fairy tales and the impossible? And there's all these writers, I think some of the greatest writers of the past 20 years, who really hold a lot of that magic in their work. And I think about Toni Morrison, who has trickster figures and ghosts in some of her greatest work, and George Saunders, and Jessamyn Ward, who I really love. And I thought, okay, can a book be reality-based, but also still have some of that impossible in it? So that was kind of the challenge I set to myself. And so I really tried very hard to keep the book close to my experience. And then it wandered off. I would begin each writing session by thinking about a memory and exploiting it and sort of letting it enrich itself. And then I'd kind of ask myself, what if? So it's really close to my life in that there are places I've been and things I've done and people I've known, and it's really far away from my life at the same time. So I have found texts in it, things that, you know, like I went through my teenage diaries, and if you really want to embarrass yourself and feel shame, reread your teenage diaries and then publish a book with some of them in it. And then there are things, you know, Cloud doesn't exist, and I'm not a drug addict. So, so there are things that are really far away. And we can talk more about the addiction part of it, too, if you want.
I'd like to. Yeah, I think that you introduced the character Emily, who is Melly's sponsor. Now we're in Melly's adult life, and I want to say she's 36, 37, 38. Correct me if I'm wrong, Melly.
Yeah, that's right. She's in her mid-30s.
Mid-30s, and she is 29 days clean when this SUV shows up in her driveway. She has her sponsor, Emily, who really empathized with her because both of them have children and they've struggled with addiction. And Emily seems to be the person that has finally reached her, set her on a path, and given her, you know, a look at what her life could be like if she didn't change it quickly. And I'll let you take it from there because, again, I don't want to give too much away. But now at this point in her life, everything seems to be going a little bit better. She's, you know, she's struggling still. She's having trouble feeding her daughter and caring for her. Her daughter falls down the stairs at one point. But she's really trying. And then this person from her past comes back.
Yeah. So, as I said before, one of the long-term consequences of cloud use is that people experience a kind of forgetting. So, Melly has snippets of her past life, things she holds on to, but she's not even sure of the memories she retains. For example, she doesn't know who her child's father is. This man appears, and she has an instant response to him. She says, it feels like being high again to see him. So she has this powerful emotional reaction, but no memories. So she doesn't know, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Can she trust him? And I think even though this sounds like a really out there idea, it really gets back to a pretty simple question that I think a lot of people have experienced and certainly will be familiar to addicts and those who've loved them, which is, what if you love someone and you love them deeply, but you know they're not good for you. Can you resist that pull? And that's the question Millie has to face.
And she faces that with Emily trying to provide some guidance. And also Emily sort of taking Melly's daughter under her wing. I've read in a few articles that some people think the central question of your book is, should a mother who is struggling with addiction have care of her daughter? I don't know if that's the question you meant to ask, but that's what some people have indicated. But that falls along the same lines as what you mentioned. So what is Emily's role in all of this, knowing this imminent danger is in Melly's life? She has to decide what to sacrifice, because there will be a sacrifice. What's Emily's role?
Yeah, so Emily is the queen of tough love. She's a Boston native, and she's got bleach blonde hair, and she's got a middle school son, and she won't take any BS, if you'll excuse me, from Melly. So when Melly tries to say she's doing well and she's not, Emily's the one to say, listen, you've got to get real and you've got to take this seriously. And more importantly, you're a mom. She's the one who keeps pulling Melly back to the idea of her responsibility as a mother. So she's a figure that I had a lot of affection for as I wrote. And I think she's less a person that I knew and more an embodiment of that person we all wish would be there for us in our dark times, the truth teller who's still full of compassion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How deep do you want to go into the story, Melanie?
Well, we can as deep as you want. I mean, it's 366 pages, and I think that there are surprises. There are lots of surprises. We couldn't spoil it all.
I was telling our news team this morning on our call that I've been reading the book all week, and they said, how long is the book? I said, it's 362 pages, but every page is a surprise or a twist or something, because we are living the experience of Melly, and she's trying to rebuild the fragments of her memory because of Cloud. And that's another question I had. How did you become this character, get to know this character in this way, so that the story is written in a way that the reader is really experiencing the drug?
You know, that's been one of the delights about sharing the book with people. You know, now that it's almost out in the world and a few people like yourself have had the chance to read it, is that something that people say to me is that sometimes the book, reading the book, feels like they're on cloud. Mm-hmm. That there is this weird kind of disorientation and then all these twists and turns that feel like how it might be to forget and then resurrect parts of your life. I think it's not something I set out to do necessarily. It's not something I was conscious of trying to do as I wrote, was to create this experience, although I'm really happy that it happened. I think that for Melly, she's trying to discover what's essential about herself. And I think that's very much like the writing journey, right? I mean, I'm trying to figure out, okay, who is this character? What makes her tick? And so I think that's part of how it ended up in the book. And then this is a very bizarre little detail, but Cloud is manufactured on plastic spoons. And it's made in basements, cooked kind of the same way that meth is. It's a chemical, but it's put on the ends of plastic spoons and then wrapped in saran wrap. And that came from, I worked as a first grade teacher in Compton, California. And my students would bring me these lunchbox snacks, and I didn't know what they were because I'd never seen them before, but they brought them that same way. That's the way their moms packed it for lunch. And they wanted me to take them and eat them, and I didn't know what it was. And they all spoke Spanish, and my Spanish was only so-so. And so they told me it was pulpo, and pulpo is the word for, or almost the word for octopus. So I thought they were trying to get me to eat octopus, but it turns out to be the same word as for pulp. So it was tamarind pulp. And that's kind of where I get the idea of the manufacture of Cloud.
Interesting. I was going to ask you that too, because, and then it changes, the development or the production of the drug changes over time in the story, and then it turns into a paper-like substance.
Yeah, then it's more, I guess they get more sophisticated, as drug producers do. You know, we don't think of drug production as a business, but of course it is, with its own technologies and its own innovations. And so, yeah, Clad Production innovates and ends up being served in flat squares, kind of like, I say, a fruit roll-up. Mm-hmm. And the connection between Clad and these candies or these treats that kids have is intentional, right? Because that's kind of how it looks to someone who's too young for it, like something that would be a treat or good, when in fact it isn't, and it's very dangerous.
So Melly starts taking Clad when she's 16. She does graduate high school. She goes to a college in New York City, and as I mentioned before, big ambitions, very motivated, but that changes because of her drug use. She struggles to get through school. She struggles to maintain her job at a muffin shop down in New York City. She's dating a childhood friend, Paul, for a while, and then they move to LA. That came from a job opportunity. And Melanie, do you want to talk a little bit about where that opportunity began and then how it developed? Because eventually that has something to do with her past that threatens her sobriety.
Yeah, so she ends up at a function, and I can't say too much about what the occasion for the function is, but she meets the father of an old friend, and this man works in film, but it's not legitimate film. He produces X-rated films. And he invites Melly to come work on the production end. So she's never on camera, but still she's part of this seedy world of the production of adult films. And she sees a lot and experiences a lot. And also, I think, feels the ghost of shame, right? She's taking enough Clad that she doesn't fully experience her feelings. But she's there and she's part of this exploitation, this exploitative industry. And it turns dark and violent as I think life for a lot of people who end up in that industry does.
Mm-hmm. I know we have a couple of listeners with questions for you, Melanie, and we will take our only break of the hour and get to those next. Plus, I'd like to talk about your writing experience or your writing process, your writing shed, and some other things related to publishing and marketing a book during the pandemic. I know we're living in unprecedented times, and this is something you've been working on for a while, and here we are in 2020 looking at a very different landscape than that which you may have anticipated. So we'll take our short break and more with Melanie Conroy Goldman next.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, Nationwide Insurance is closing all 5 regional offices and letting all workers work from home permanently. The CEO says working from home turns out to be much more productive than he thought, and that's a permanent change, pandemic or not. So what's the future of work? What have employees learned in the last several months? We'll talk about it Monday.
This is Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about the debut novel of Melanie Conroy Goldman. It's called The Likely World. It's a novel that is, I am so impressed by this. It's remarkable work. And listeners, if you're looking for something on your summer reading list or for your summer reading list, I highly recommend it. And we have lots more with Melanie coming up next, but let's get to the phones first. Up first is Shadi in Denver. Go ahead, Shadi.
Hi, congratulations on your book. It sounds amazing.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I'm a writer myself. I've been working on a humor memoir for the past couple of years, and I'm collaborating with an editor, and I anticipate that sometime next year I'll be close to the first final manuscript. I was wondering more about your process and general advice on whether during this pandemic it's better to go through the self-publishing route, to talk to agents, And then I've heard of sort of having a free agent or talking to an agent with a publishing company. It's just a very overwhelming world, and I was hoping you could share your process and maybe give me some advice on where to start when I get sort of close to the end of my first manuscript here. And then there's the issue of, you know, if it is a publishing company, how to communicate with an agent, when to start communicating, and sort of creating a buzz around a book, and so on and so forth. So any general advice, I appreciate.
Absolutely. Thanks for your question, Shadi. And humor memoir sounds really good. So I'm sure it's going to find a great home. I've been fortunate during this pandemic to be in touch with lots and lots of different writers. There are wonderful organizations like A Mighty Blaze and Lockdown Literature. We've just been groups of people lifting each other up. And so I'm hearing from people who are having lots of different processes, people who are self-publishing and finding great success with that and really connecting with their audience. And people who are going the traditional route of finding an agent and then linking up with a publishing house. And I think that either of those paths can really work. I wouldn't cut one possibility off or the other. My first piece of advice is why not try an agent, but at the same time look into self-publishing and connect with other writers who are doing that and can share their experience with you. Because whatever you do in this day and age, you're going to be marketing yourself. That's just how it is. And so the same skills really apply to both. And are you on Twitter?
I'm not. I'm on Facebook and Instagram, but I can get a Twitter.
I just love the writing community on Twitter. I think people, there's such a diversity of ways people have gone about it, and people are really willing to lift each other up and share information, and it's also a great way to find people who follow different paths. And I think it's a great way to connect with a writer who might have an idea that's different from yours. And actually, people pitch on Twitter. It's really, really great. And there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of people following the hashtag writing community on Twitter. So there's definitely people out there who are interested in your work and who can help you. Is there something else I can tell you?
That's really helpful. Thank you so much. I did attend a Lit Fest in Rochester a couple of years ago and spoke to a few agents. Are those individuals that years later I can still reach out to? And if so, when do I do that? And when do I start pitching to any agent, even if it's through Twitter?
Absolutely. That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. Yes, you can still reach out to them, and you can also reach out to agents you've never talked to before. You can just send your manuscript. There's no bar. There's no qualification you have to send your manuscript. I would say that you want to get your manuscript into the best shape it can possibly be before you start pitching. Because even if you're just sending a pitch, if an agent replies, I want to see the book, you want to send it to them right away, and you want it to be as good as you can personally make it without their help.
That sounds wonderful. And how did you protect your own interests once you got an agent? I'm assuming that's the route you went.
I mean, with any agent I have personally talked to, any legitimate agent, you shouldn't have to worry about protecting your own interests. They're your agent, right? And their job is to protect you and get you the best deal possible. But, you know, it's worth doing some homework because I think there are, unfortunately, some individuals out there who are asking for money or, who are maybe out there posing as agents and more exploitative. Pretty easy to find out their background because people share information.
Right. Well, thank you for your answers. And again, congratulations on the the book launch, and I wish you the best.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Shadi. Good luck with your book as well.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Sounds like some ties to Rochester there. Melanie, that leads me to my next question about your book. When did you first start writing The Likely World?
So I started in 2013 and in January, it was about, I think I started writing it either just before or just after I met my future husband. So he's definitely in the pages of the book. And I was a single mom at the time. I had a 5-year-old, and I'd also quit smoking 5 days earlier or 8 days earlier. So that sort of struggle with addiction is also written into the book.
So 7 years later, you are launching your book in the middle of a pandemic. When did the process, Shadi mentioned, agent self-publishing? I know you have quite the story with your agent, and he had a particular interest in your narrative. How did you connect with him?
So I initially sent the book out to 10 agents to look at, and I had some kind of introduction to 9 of them, and the 10th was just a total shot in the dark. This guy, Bill Clegg, has some really incredible writers on his list, Otessa Moshfegh and Lauren Groff, people who have made the bestseller list, and I just thought, you know, why not? And at the time, I had a problem with my email where, for some reason, it would insert a question mark at the beginning of everything I wrote. So instead of saying, here's a book, it seemed to say, here's a book. And instead of saying, would you like to take a look at it? It was more like, would you like to take a look at it? My agent was upstate entertaining at his house in the Hudson Valley, entertaining at his house for the weekend. And he opened the email and he was confused. And he told me later, I never open the attachments. I just don't do it. He has assistance for that. But because my email was so weird, he just clicked on the attachment and he ignored his guests and he kept reading the book. And he finished it, and then he called me, and he became my agent. So
wow.
There was a lot of luck involved, and also a bad email program.
Question marks. I hope aspiring writers, if you're trying to shop your book, I don't know if that's advice, but what a great story. Oh, my goodness. And I know that you mentioned to me that he has some, he had a particular interest in the addiction narrative.
Well, yeah, that's right. And it's not a secret. It's on his Wikipedia page, and he's written memoirs about addiction and also a really wonderful novel called Did You Ever Have a Family that deals with that subject. But he himself had real struggles with addiction and went into recovery. And one of the things I was most honored by in his response was that the addiction narrative really connected to him. And I felt like he's someone who knows.
Have you heard from people who have struggled with addiction or maybe people who work in recovery? Have you heard from them about the book? I know it's not officially out there yet, but you have had some advanced copies circulating. Is that a community you hope to connect with more?
Absolutely. And one of my early readers actually is my sister, and she has been in recovery for a long time. She quit substances when she was 19 or 18. So she's read some of it, and she corrected some things and gave me some advice about it. So that's been really important. But no, it still remains to be read by people who have experience with that. And I want to be clear that I myself have had struggles with addiction, and I'm not in a 12-step program, but my family has really benefited, and I have enormous respect, and I honor the people who lift each other up within that community.
You're hearing from Melanie Conroy-Goldman. She's the author of The Likely World. It's her debut novel, and she's also a professor of English at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, living in Ithaca right now, writing in a shed. We'll talk about that in a moment. But listeners, if you have questions for her or comments, if you'd like advice, if you're an aspiring writer, if you have questions about the process, you can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. That's 263-WXXI. You can also email the program at connections@WXXI.org. Our email is back, so please feel free to use it. And I'm on Twitter at MMacMedia. But Melanie, let's talk about creative writing programs. We had you on, I think it was 2016, the last time you were on the program, talking about to MFA or not to MFA. And I'd like to get your take on creative writing programs at the college and graduate level. What's your writing experience? Did you benefit from a creative writing program?
I did. So as an undergrad, I was an English major, but I took creative writing classes. And then I did do an MFA at the University of Oregon, which was a wonderful experience for me. And I think anyone who can have an experience like I did with mentors who are present and continue to be lifelong friends and a cohort of people who support you, I can't imagine anything better. I'm still in touch with and sharing work with people that I went to school with, and it was just a marvelous experience for me.
We talked with Sejal Shah recently about her new book, and a lot of her writing reflects those experiences that she had in different writing programs and the community that was created. How important do you think that is? Is it important for everyone to have that kind of a community? I'm sure some people work more on an individual or solitary level, but what advice do you have for people who are considering programs? Is that community important?
Well, there are exceptions to any rule. So there probably are writers out there who work in solitude and don't need other people. But I think almost every writer that I know needs readers, needs people to get them through the inevitable rejection. That's part of the process. But you don't need to make that community through an MFA. I mean, an organization like Writers in Books is a great place to build community, or people can connect with writers online through something like Twitter, or you can just stick up a notice at your local bookstore, you know, back when we have bookstores that we can go to, and start a writers group. So I think everybody needs people to read, to share their work, to inspire them. But I don't think everybody needs an MFA.
Who has influenced you? Who are some of the writers that you respect and admire?
Well, some of those writers who are writing kind of in that imaginative space that I talked about earlier. And I think about Toni Morrison, who I already mentioned, who I just think is an amazing craftswoman and is sorely missed. And Stephen Milhauser, who has a wonderful book called We Others, which just has everything you could imagine, aliens, an alternate universe set in basically IKEA that's underground, George Saunders, mm-hmm. who's so amazing, Lydia Yuknovich, whose collection Verge has some great writing on addiction in it, and Mary Gateskill, who I was honored to have blurb the book and also worked with us at Hobart and William Smith College as part of the Trias writing program.
I think upstate New York in the Finger Lakes region is very fortunate in the sense that we have this great community of writers. Some of the people you just mentioned, Mary Gateskill, George Saunders, you are here. I don't know if that's true of all communities, but I think, are we unique in that sense? Writers in Books is, I think, a local gem. And
yeah.
Are we privileged in that sense?
We're dense with writers. I mean, we're absolutely dense. We've been talking about fiction writers, but this is also a great place for poets and memoirists like Sejal Shah. And not only are there lots of us, but we're connected, you know, through things like your program, your book week, and through organizations like Writers in Books. So I do think we're especially fortunate in that way.
I'm glad to hear that everyone is very collaborative and complimentary. I was part of a program, a comedy training program, several years ago in a different community, and it was very competitive. And we were part of a little conservatory. We were growing together, learning together for the course of a year. I learned a lot. I don't regret any of it. But once that program ended, it felt like all those bonds and those connections went off in different directions and people became a bit competitive, which I understand. It's part of the industry. It's very cutthroat in some cities especially. But it sounds like it's a bit different in the literary world, or is that too much of a generalization?
You know, there's bad apples out there. There's, but I think the days of creative writing community that centers around one kind of guru who pronounces on whether work is good or bad, I think that those bad old days are over. And I certainly had teachers like that, but I think that at least the people I know and that I stay connected to are really interested in helping you know, new writers find their voice, figure out where they fit in, develop themselves, and build connection to other people. You know, that's what I've learned from my best colleagues. I work with a woman named Catherine Coles, who's just a terrific teacher, and she's really interested in helping her students gain awareness of how they write and helping them see each other's writing. And I think that's the best we can do for each other and the best we can do for ourselves.
I'd like to ask you about your writing shed. I've hinted at it several times.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen it on your blog.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful shed.
Thank you very much.
Was the shed built just for the book?
Yes, basically. You know, it's funny, and I don't want to give anyone jealousy problems here, but my husband just went out back and started building it. And he happens to have those skills. And it's beautiful. It has a hardwood floor and a slanted roof. It's only half painted, but he assures me that at some point it will be all one color. I think maybe it was because of the pandemic. We had three kids at home, and I needed a place to write. And so he made it for me.
How did your writing process work? Do you have a set time every day that you sit down and you spend a certain amount of time writing? Do you just write when you're inspired?
Well, my writing process is one that no one should emulate. I am a daily writer, but the way I write is I basically figuratively bang my head against the wall until something good comes out. And that's no way to live, but it is how I live. And it's very trial and error. I think I tried maybe 9 full drafts of this book before I really arrived at something that I felt satisfied with. And I think people listen to writers talk about their process and they think, oh, if only I could do it this way, then it would be easier. And what I really encourage every person who is trying to write to do and thinking about it is figure out what your process is. Whatever it is, however you write best, trust that. And maybe you need to walk every day, and maybe you need to do it at night, maybe you need to do it in the morning, maybe you wait on inspiration, maybe you write with a friend. Whatever it is, cultivate it and protect it. And don't let anyone else tell you how to write.
And maybe you build a shed.
Yes. maybe you marry the right guy.
We're down to our last few minutes with Melanie Conroy Goldman talking about her book, The Likely World. I know you have a class coming up at Writers and Books. It's August 15th, and it's called The Circle and the Line. And it drew my attention because it's all about how time exists in novels. So there's linear time, and then there's time that exists in a different way. Tell us a little bit about the class and if it reflects on the book at all.
Yeah, so one of the things that fiction does that I think few other writing forms can is that time is completely malleable. So 100 years can pass in a sentence, and 1 second can take a chapter. And so that gives the writer lots of tools, but it also creates sometimes too many options. So I think a lot about time. Most novels have a spine that's linear. First things first, second things second, third things third. But they also have these kind of meditations or circles that exist inside of them. And I think the easiest way to think about it is like a detective novel, right, where the detective is trying to solve the crime but has to keep returning to clues and thinking about them a new way and coming up with, you know, that one scrap of paper means one thing in the beginning and then something else later on and something else towards the end. And that's kind of the circle that I think is present in a lot of books.
Is it present in the likely world?
It is. I mean, because of this idea of forgetting, right? Mm-hmm. So Melly thinks she knows something, and then she encounters a new memory or something sparks a new memory, and she has to go back to that thing she thought she knew and remake it. But at the same time, you know, there's a set of mysteries, and there's a time limit. She has to fix some problems really quickly, or everything's going to explode in her life. So I've got the linear time and the circle, and I guess thinking about those things was what led me to want to teach this class.
Mm-hmm. I felt that way reading the book. I thought, oh, I figured this out. I understand who this person is or what they're after. And then I found out, no, I don't quite know yet. I'm still confused. It's just such an interesting read in that regard. It's also a beautiful story and something, listeners, if you're looking for a novel this summer, I recommend. It's officially out on Tuesday, August 4th. You can meet Melanie in person at the Finger Lakes Drive-In Theater on Tuesday the 4th, launch day, from 8 to 11 p.m. And there's also her virtual reading at Writers and Books via Zoom, and that's on August 6th, next Thursday, from 7 to 7:30. That event is free, but you have to register at wab.org. And Melanie, in our last minute or so, remind our audience where they can find The Likely World.
They can find it wherever books are sold, and I encourage them to link to it through Ampersand Books, which is sponsored by Writers and Books.
Thank you so much for spending the hour with us, talking about your work and your process, and congratulations. This is a huge accomplishment.
Thank you so much, Megan. This has been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Nice way to end our week this way, too. It's Friday. We're heading into the weekend. Listeners, I hope you have an enjoyable weekend, a safe one, a peaceful one. Rob Braden is our engineer, and it's his birthday. Happy birthday, Rob. Thanks to Barsook Records and Rara Riot for our theme. Thanks to Melanie Conroy Goldman for her book and her work and joining me. I'm Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson. We will talk to you next week.